In the early part of the 20th century, the genetic view was predominant. Most people assumed that there were natural differences between groups that explained why some did better than others. But in the 1950s and 1960s, the genetic view came under sustained assault. The liberals said, "How can you say that blacks are doing poorly due to some supposed natural deficit? Look at all the discrimination to which they are subjected." This argument was entirely plausible, which is why the genetic view began to lose support and the liberal view became the conventional wisdom. Today, however, the liberal view has become intellectually bankrupt. To see why this is so, consider the SAT. Both on the verbal and the math section of the test, Asian Americans and whites who come from poor families, let us say families earning below $20,000 a year, score higher than African Americans who come from well-off families, say families earning over $60,000 a year. This fact, which is easy to verify and is not denied by any informed person in the race debate, destroys the old canard that tests are mere caps of socioeconomic privilege. But it also poses a grave challenge to the liberal position itself. Recall that the liberal view attributes group differences in performance to racism. But how could racism operate in such a way that it enables poor whites and Asians to score higher on math tests than upper middle class African Americans? When I pose this question to liberal scholars, they usually call me insulting names. So the debate is at a tragic standoff between two unacceptable alternatives, the genetic position and the liberal position. To break the deadlock, a group of scholars, including Tom Sowell, Orlando Patterson, and Shelby Steele, has offered a third position that I support. This may be called the cultural position. This view holds that there are cultural, which is to say behavioral, differences between groups. These are observable in everyday life, they can be measured by the usual techniques of social science, and they can be directly related to academic achievement and economic success. A few years ago, sociologist Sanford Dornbush and his colleagues were puzzled by the persistence of large differences in academic performance between Asian Americans and African Americans. They were disturbed by the possibility that these differences might be due to natural or genetic factors. So Dornbush and his colleagues conducted a comparative study of white, black, Hispanic, and Asian American students. Here is what they found. In general, Asian American students devote relatively more time to their studies, are more likely to attribute their success to hard work, and are more likely to report that their parents have high standards for school performance. In contrast, African American and Hispanic students are more cavalier about the consequences of poor school performance, devote less time to their studies, are less likely than others to attribute their success to hard work, and report that their parents have relatively lower standards. Obviously, this doesn't settle the issue. One may ask, but why do Asian Americans and African Americans show these differences in attitude and behavior? Undoubtedly, many complex factors are involved, but one that is worth mentioning is the two-parent family. It seems obvious that two parents will have, on average, more time than a single parent to invest in a child's upbringing, discipline, homework supervision, and so on. What is the illegitimacy rate in the Asian American community? Less than 5%. In the African American community, nearly 70%. I mentioned these facts at a recent conference and one of my fellow panelists erupted in anger. "Yes, but who do you think caused the decline of the black family? Clearly it is the result of slavery." He went on to remind me that in no southern state were slaves legally permitted to marry and that masters periodically broke up families and sold off children. All of this is sadly true. And the argument sounds so reasonable that it is only by looking at the facts that we see that it is largely erroneous. In the early part of the 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois published his study of the black family, in which he pointed out that the illegitimacy rate for blacks in the United States was around 20%. From 1900 to 1965, the black illegitimacy rate remained roughly at that figure. Indeed, in 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan did his famous report on the Negro family and announced a national scandal. The black illegitimacy rate had reached 25%. Let us concede that slavery was primarily responsible for that figure. After emancipation, however, African Americans made strenuous attempts to reunite and rebuild their families. This is a black success story that is not well known. Black activists don't publicize it because it disrupts the profitable narrative of victimization. Ironically, it is during the period from 1965 to the present, a period that saw the Great Society, the civil rights laws, affirmative action, welfare, and other attempts to integrate blacks into the mainstream and raise their standard of living, that the black family disintegrated. Today, that disintegration has reached the point that the typical African-American child is born out of wedlock. The African-American sociologist William Julius Wilson concedes the existence of cultural pathologies like illegitimacy and high crime rates in the black community. He blames these not on slavery, but on racism, poverty, and unemployment. Wilson points out, for example, that a young black man who doesn't have a job is in no position to support a family. Who should be surprised, therefore, that he gets a girl pregnant and refuses to marry her? The problem with Wilson's analysis is that it ignores the historical record. Consider the period of the 1930s in the segregationist South. Racism, poverty, and unemployment were rampant. Yet what was the black illegitimacy rate? It remained at 20%. The black crime rate? It was a lot lower than it is now. Neither Wilson nor anyone else has explained why, at a time when economic and social conditions have greatly improved for blacks, these cultural problems have worsened. Let me summarize my argument by re-examining the debate in the early 20th century between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. Although the debate focused on black Americans, it is relevant to the question of how any group, starting out at the bottom, can advance in society. Du Bois, a distinguished scholar and co-founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, argued that African Americans in the United States face one big problem, and it is racism. Washington, who was born a slave, but went on to become the head of the Tuskegee Institute, maintained that African Americans face two big problems. One is racism, he conceded. The other, he said, is black cultural disadvantage. Washington said that black crime rates were too high, black savings rates were too low, blacks did not have enough respect for educational achievement. Du Bois countered that these problems, if they existed, were due to the legacy of slavery and racism. Washington did not disagree, but he insisted that, whatever their source, these cultural problems demanded attention. What is the point of having rights, Washington said, without the ability to exercise those rights and compete effectively with other groups? To put the matter in contemporary terms, there is little benefit in having the right to a job at General Motors if you don't know how to do the job. Washington further argued that if these cultural deficiencies were not addressed, they would help to strengthen racism by giving it an empirical foundation. The civil rights movement led by the NAACP fought for decades to implement the Du Bois program and secure basic rights for black Americans. This was a necessary campaign, and ultimately it was successful. The laws were changed, and blacks achieved their goal of full citizenship. Obviously, enforcement remained an issue, but at this point, it seems to me, the Du Bois program was largely achieved. At this crucial juncture, the civil rights movement should have moved from the Du Bois agenda to the Booker T. Washington agenda. Unfortunately, this did not happen. It still hasn't happened. Even today, the NAACP and other civil rights groups continue to agitate to achieve black progress. This is the approach that Jesse Jackson has perfected. It draws on the language and tactics of political struggle to make gains. But how significant are those gains? A few years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., and there was a big march on the Mall. all the major civil rights groups were represented. Several speakers ascended the podium, thumped their fists, and said, "We've got to go to Bill Clinton and demand 300,000 new jobs."